Hi, Patrick Cox here with a spiritual pod, a thinky pod. What happens when a group of influential people find themselves discussing a highly sensitive issue in translation? More than that, not just translation, but what they suspect is deliberate mistranslation. Also today, silence. I love this version of The Sound of Silence. It's by the Dickies. I guess I like it so much because if there's one thing it isn't, it's silent. Hello, darkness, my friend. I've come to talk to you again. Because the vision so late began. Let me teach when I was began. Despite the glories of this song, a state of pure, wordless silence is good for you. That's coming up. But before I hit that mute button, I have to tell you about this language and translation argument among Catholic bishops. Bishops from around the world right now are winding up their synod in Rome. This is a meeting that the Pope calls whenever he sees fit. The subject of this synod is the Church's teaching on the family. Nice, easy chat then. No way. Not when society's views of the family are changing so rapidly right now and so dramatically, which makes this argument over language and translation all the more poignant. Here's Matthew Bell.
This sort of Catholic summit has been happening for 50 years. It aims to help the Vatican stay in touch with church leaders from every corner of the Catholic world. There are 270 bishops from all over. They're organized into 13 different language groups, English-speaking ones here, French there, and so on. They have one goal, to come up with a single document of their findings to present to Pope Francis by the end of the week. And the final version of that document will be written in the lingua franca of the Catholic Church.
Bene, i fotografi hanno fatto il loro lavoro. Grazie.
Italian is the native language of Father Federico Lombardi, director of the Vatican's press office. Italian is also the official language for all synod business. That's new. Pope Francis made that change 2 years ago. Prior to that, when bishops gathered for a synod, they produced documents in Latin. Switching to Italian has not been seamless. Archbishop Charles Chaput of Philadelphia brought up the language issue at the start of this synod.
That's a concern. Actually, one of the difficulties we had was, as we looked at the document, was some of the bishops wanted to analyze it word by word, and it isn't the official document. We have the English translation, which in some ways doesn't match the Italian, which is the official version, because they were worried about what does this word mean to our people. Can it be misinterpreted? Will it be used against the church rather than in favor of the church?
Chaput is hinting at the problem of accuracy, not just linguistic, but ideological accuracy. Here's an example of what he's talking about. At last year's synod, there was a scandal over the translation of a sentence about how the church views gays and lesbians. Here's what the original Italian said.
Accogliere le persone omosessuali.
And the key word here is
accogliere,
which is usually translated as the verb to welcome. But the English version that the American bishops were given translated it into to provide. So when the original Italian document said that the Catholic Church would welcome gays and lesbians, it suggested a dramatic change in doctrine. But the English translation did not convey that sense. The suspicion was that translations were being manipulated so as to not upset conservative English-speaking bishops. The anxiety about translations has carried over to this year's synod. Massimo Fagioli is an expert on Catholic theology at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota.
In the previous synods, nobody was complaining about the accurateness or not of the translations of the text, because in the previous synods, those texts didn't matter at all.
Because under previous popes, the synods worked very differently. The bishops gathered for the purpose of rubber-stamping Vatican policy. Fagioli says there was no real debate over the true meaning of the official text.
But now these texts matter. So they know that if they vote on one text or another, that might change the direction of the Catholic Church on some teachings, which was not something anybody was thinking about under John Paul II or Pope Benedict.
Pope Francis says he wants a more decentralized church, and he has encouraged the bishops to speak boldly, even about subjects on which they disagree, like premarital cohabitation or offering communion to people who've been divorced and remarried. Not all of the bishops are enthusiastic about the wisdom of a truly open debate. Fagioli says that includes some conservative American bishops who don't have the best Italian language skills.
The language issue is just one way for them to express their lack of confidence in this idea that debate is healthy. Many of them don't think that issues should be debated too much because that might lead to changes they don't believe in.
But Fagioli says it does make sense for Italian to be the official language of Catholicism. Unlike Latin, it's a living language of the real world. English is already the default language for international business and finance, and it's a symbol of the Western world's power. Fagioli says Italian is more politically neutral and therefore more acceptable to people from poorer countries. And besides, the Vatican is still located in Rome.
The Big Show's Matthew Bell. And you'd have thought, with all of those translation problems the Catholic Church is having right now, a vow of silence might come in handy. You could just forget about all of those pesky words and their mistranslations. Let's all just shut up. Okay, I can't keep this up for very long. Not under these circumstances. Kind of defeats the purpose of a podcast. But beyond that, beyond the world of podcasting, there are other ways to be silent.
Anyone who's ever been on a silent retreat will
A silent retreat? Is this a common thing to do? Like, if you want to do something a little quieter on your time off, a little quieter than, I don't know, Vegas or Burning Man? Bad examples. I haven't been to them either. Anyway, this is writer Philip Hensher, and I won't interrupt again.
Anyone who's ever been on a silent retreat will realize how vital how people talk is, because you make judgments about the people around the table. You haven't heard them speak. You come to a conclusion about what they're like, and then at the end of the week you get in a taxi to go to the station and they speak, and you're always completely wrong. And you realise that you would have made completely different judgments about them if you'd heard them talk, if you'd heard the timbre of their voice, all sorts of things.
Okay, Philip Hensher, there is some truth in silence, or at least a less mediated version of the truth. But there's increasing evidence of more than that. Yes, more than the truth. There's evidence that keeping your trap shut, just dispensing with words for a while, is good for you. I know that's not news to worshippers of certain religions or practitioners of meditation, but it is news to most of the medical establishment and to the BBC's David Sillitoe.
Just taking whatever time you need to settle.
I'm in a room at the London School of Economics. My eyes are closed. Thoughts are popping up. What shall I have for tea? What am I doing here? Each time I try to return to the matter in hand, breathing.
And if your mind wanders off dozens of times, that's fine. It's just what minds do.
It's a form of meditation called mindfulness. There's no religion, no chanting, no incense. And according to our meditation teacher, Michael Chaskelson, it's a scientifically proven way of combating stress and depression.
I started studying mindfulness academically in 2003. And around about that time, there were approximately 60 reasonable quality peer-reviewed studies published. Now they're coming out at the rate of more than 40 each month.
In the US, the Marines are now trialling it. They call it mind fitness training. Meditation's changing image has been driven by neuroscience. One famous study was of a Buddhist monk, Matthew Ricard. He was wired up and tested for activity in the brain that was thought to be linked with openness, kindness, happiness. The results were off the scale. He was dubbed by the press
the happiest man in the world.
I tried to make so many disclaimers, no one believes me.
The title is an embarrassment, but the science intrigues him.
There's an activation of some areas of the brain that has to do with positive effect that were activated in a way that was so far unreported in neuroscience. And so it was remarkable.
But when, in the wake of this, the Dalai Lama was invited to speak to a conference of neuroscientists, there were objections, fears that religion and science should not mix. But secular mindfulness courses are now proliferating, And I chose perhaps the best known one, mindfulness-based stress reduction, which was developed at Massachusetts General Hospital. Alongside me, Fiona Assassin. I've known her for 20 years, and she's here because of pain. She has the condition lupus.
At the moment, it hurts in my lower back, my neck, my left shoulder, right knee.
8 weeks later, we went to Elena Antonova, a neuroscientist at King's College's Institute of Psychiatry, and spent an hour in an MRI machine.
Can you please keep your eyes closed and allow your mind to wander, OK?
Fiona's views about the meditation were positive, but what did the images show? Elena Antonova said she could see that she was in real pain, but the area that responded emotionally to the pain, the anterior cingulate, that seemed to have calmed during the meditation.
So this sort of shows the... to my mind, when I practice it, it's not that the pain goes, but it's I can almost take it down a few notches, and that's physically showing
it
that.
It seems to be consistent with your experience.
Oh, wow! Gosh, that's amazing.
We sent the results to an independent pain researcher at another university, and he said it was a valid interpretation.
I knew what it was doing, and I use it all the time, and it helps me with my pain. But there is something very powerful about knowing there is physical, objective proof that it's working.
But what about me? My scan showed a worrying lack of activity in the front of my brain.
Definitely the activity have shifted to the posterior bit of the brain from the frontal lobe, and that's generally, you know, the posterior activation are seen in Franciscan nuns, for example, or Tibetan monks during meditation.
A Franciscan nun. I wasn't expecting that. Our two scans, though, don't really stand up as scientific proof. The images are open to alternative interpretation. But others are studying this rather more seriously, trying to see if the route to happiness is, for a few minutes each day, silence.
David Sillitoe is with the BBC. And just to encourage him and you and me to summon up the Franciscan nun within us. Here's a piece of music sung by the Franciscan nuns of St. Joseph's in Asumbe, Kenya. It's not silence, but it is quite lovely. That's it for the show this time. We're at pri.org/language. We're also on iTunes, Stitcher, and all those other podcast delivery services. If you listen via one of those services, please write a review of The World in Words. It's easy, it takes no time, and it really helps in getting the word out, so to speak. We're also on Facebook at The World in Words page. There is a brand new World in Words Twitter presence, too. Our handle is LingoPod. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI. Oh.